I am Silas House. We are on the porch here at WUKY. We have a special guest with us who has a new book out that's getting a lot of great buzz. Joseph Crespino is considered one of the top young historians in the country right now, and he specializes in the history of the modern South and of modern conservatism. He serves as the Jimmy Carter Chair in American History at Emory University in Atlanta. He's the author of Strom Thurmond's America, a political biography of the longtime U.S. Senator from South Carolina, and the book In Search of Another Country, Mississippi and the Conservative Counter-Revolution, which won the Lillian Smith Book Award and many other honors. You most likely know the music of his wife, Caroline Herring, whom has been a guest on this show before. Today, I'm really happy to talk to him about Atticus Finch, the biography, which examines one of the most beloved figures in literature, the father in the classic novel, To Kill a Mockingbird, and the inferior but very interesting companion novel, Go Set a Watchman. You might recognize this iconic theme to the film of To Kill a Mockingbird. In Atticus Finch, the biography, which I just finished, Crespino uses incredible research with exclusive sources to reveal how Harper Lee's father provided the central inspiration for Atticus Finch, how the film version of Atticus differs from the novels, how the civil rights movement was impacted by the book, and much more. It's a really original and interesting take on a character and a novel that has held the public's imagination for almost 60 years now. It's also beautifully written, and I couldn't put it down. We're actually recording this on the publication day of the book, so let me begin by saying congratulations, Joe, for your book officially being in the world.
Oh, thank you so much, Silas. It's great to be here to speak with you about it.
I'm so glad for you. When I first read To Kill a Mockingbird, I was in seventh grade, and like many of its readers, I've loved these characters and its author ever since. And since then, I have read everything that I could find about Harper Lee. Yet I was really struck by how much new knowledge I gained while reading your book. How did you get all of this new information?
Well, that's a good question. And I just kind of pieced it together over the years, but really over the last 2 years, because that was always the problem for me. I've been interested in this book for a long time, like you, and this character, and the way that it fits in our culture and our political culture and our understanding of history and the memory of that period in Southern history and this transition from a segregated to a desegregated South. And but there was so little to go on. There was just the novel itself and the things that were written about Harper Lee in the novel when it came out. And, of course, her last public interview, the last time she spoke on the record to anybody about her fiction, was in an interview she gave in March of 1964. And so there's just so little out there to kind of make sense of it all. And but then when Go Set a Watchman came out in the summer of 2015, that for me was like a key that unlocked so much, because whatever you think about that book as a work of fiction, and I know there are a lot of different opinions on it, but it is a fascinating kind of historical document that gives us great insight into kind of what Harper Lee was thinking about, what she was wrestling with, how she was trying to make sense of the politics of her time and what was going on in the South at that time in the mid and late 1950s. And so that set me off. Once that came out, I started digging around in a more sustained way. In the first place, and the real mother load of information was when I went back and started finding out more about her father. Her father, who we always knew, she herself had said that her father was in many ways the inspiration for the character of Atticus Finch. And we knew that A.C. Lee was a small-town lawyer and state legislator, just like Atticus. But what folks had forgotten or didn't seem to pay much particular attention to was that he was also the editor of this newspaper in Monroeville. And I went back and read that paper and read his editorials and all 18 years worth of his editorials, and they were just absolutely fascinating. And they really allowed me to kind of recreate his political and worldview, which is a good chunk of what this book is about. Not all of it, certainly, but it certainly got me going.
Yes, I love that aspect of it. I think that we learn so much about who her father was by looking at those editorials. It's such a smart move on your part.
Thank you.
So you briefly alluded to having loved the book a long time. So when you were growing up, was To Kill a Mockingbird an impactful book for you? How old were you when you read it?
You know, I've thought about this a lot since I've been writing this book. It is not a book that I look back and say, I remember reading that in eighth grade or ninth grade, and that book changed my life. I couldn't tell you. I know I read it in, I think I read it in ninth grade, is where I've tried to remember where I read it. I came back to it, though, in graduate school. My brother actually was a huge fan of the book, and when I was doing my graduate work and I was doing work on Southern political history, and my brother was like, you know, you got to go back to this book. This book is really fascinating. And so I did go back to it, and he was right. And I, you know, how it sometimes is, you reread books that you read in as a child, and they just take on a whole different cast for you. And that's how I got back into the book, is reading it actually when I was in my 20s and coming back to it that way. And just, you know, observing how that book continues to be taught and continues to kind of be situated in our culture, that it becomes this kind of primer that we assign to middle school and early high school kids to tell them about, you know, kind of racial morality. And so many kids, that's how they learn for the first time some of the history of racial injustice in this country. And so that's how I got interested in the book, just as a kind of the cultural phenomenon that it is.
Mm-hmm. Now, as much as I love To Kill a Mockingbird, I also know that it's a white fantasy.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
sometimes,
absolutely.
Sometimes I say that and people are taken aback. I said it recently in front of a large crowd and there was an audible gasp from the whole audience. But you do such a great job of examining that idea in the book. So can you talk just a little bit about what I mean by that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I love To Kill a Mockingbird, and I can't stand To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, this is the way it is, right, with things. That you, it's not just that you have these great tensions. You know, you love and hate it. And I do I have problems with Atticus Finch. He's too good to be true. Mm-hmm. He's the novel itself, the African-American characters in it are not fully developed. They're kind of cardboard characters in some ways. And Atticus is the great white hope, the great white hero who saves the day and that kind of thing. In some ways, for me and for a lot of people, I think when Watchmen, Ghost of the Watchmen came out, it was kind of a relief in some ways, because
yes.
You always knew there's an intelligence to Harper Lee's writing. Then you knew she was too smart to kind of take Atticus at face value. And so in some ways, I think I found Ghost of the Watchmen to be a relief in that sense. But we do love Atticus still, and we love that the idea of Atticus. And Harper Lee struggled with it too, as is obvious from these very different ways that she presented the character over the course of her two novels.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up about Ghost of the Watchmen. To some degree, to me, Ghost of the Watchmen, and I do, you know, I said in the introduction, it's a totally inferior book. I think that sometimes people go into it expecting it to be, you know, like To Kill a Mockingbird, and as far as how well finessed it is and all that, and it reads more like a, you know, first draft or a very early draft. So I see it more as like almost a way to understand To Kill a Mockingbird better. But what I really want to get at is that to some degree, Ghost of the Watchmen is about how people can change. And in Atticus's case, he's tempted by some racist dogma, but ultimately he does stay true to his character as a good man. Yet some people now see Atticus as a racist character because of this book. Personally, I think this is sort of a testament to what unnuanced times we live in, and the way we're not able to talk in real nuanced terms. Would you agree with that notion or not?
Well, I think one of the things, some of the exclusive sources that I've had access to were letters, memos, documents from the files of HarperCollins, Harper Lee's publisher. And they show Harper Lee's kind of creative process and how and what the, exactly the relationship was between these novels. And what's important to realize is it, you're right that that Ghost of a Watchman is a kind of apprentice novel, but she always imagined it as a separate novel, as these two separate pieces. It's not just that, say, Mockingbird is a highly a highly kind of changed version of Ghost at a Watchman, mm-hmm. highly revised version. She imagined them as two separate novels, but as part of the same narrative arc, you know, the same characters in both books, but just seen from different perspectives because they're very different parts in their lifetime. And so I do think she is trying to show a very complicated character who, from the eyes of a 9-year-old girl, looks very heroic in the stand that he took in the 1930s, but who, seen in relationship with a 26-year-old grown woman who's come back and discovered what's happening in her hometown, she sees him very differently. But what's interesting about Ghost at a Watchman is the way that the person who changes the most over the course of Ghost at a Watchman is not Atticus, but it's Jean mm-hmm. Louise, right? She's the one who learns something over the course of that novel, and she learns that Atticus can still be a member of the Citizens Council and still be a decent fella, and that's part of Harper Lee's own kind of conservative politics in 1957, mm-hmm. right? That she's writing that. What Jean Louise learns in that novel is what kind of Harper Lee is trying to tell her readers. And oftentimes I think she's imagining her readers in that novel as kind of the liberal North, right, mm-hmm. who sees the citizens' councils. And she's trying to say there's still some decent conservative segregationists, which is kind of a hard lesson for us to kind of accept in this day and age, because we know those conservative segregationists were fighting to preserve the status quo just as hard as anybody. Mm-hmm. And they weren't going to be the ones who led the South through any kind of meaningful change. And they didn't. So that novel is problematic, both as a work of fiction and as a work of kind of political critique as to what was going on in the South in the mid and late 1950s.
Joe, if you don't mind, just read us a passage from the book.
I'm going to read just the last little part of chapter 6, which is kind of a summary of a lot of what's been covered in the book and then kind of leads into the questions I try to take up in the epilogue. The disunited white South. That was the side that Harper Lee and her people were on. It was to them that she had written a novel that would eventually be read and celebrated around the world as a timeless expression of universal values of moral courage, tolerance, and understanding. But she began the project confused and uncertain. In her first attempt at writing a novel, she had wanted to reconcile her abiding love and respect for her father with the hypocrisy and injustice that he and his generation of Southerners had too easily abided, all while defending him from the condescension of the Northern liberals. Yet through that process, and shaped too by the shifting politics of the day, she stumbled upon a simpler narrative, a father, inspired by his love and hope for his children, doing the right thing in a time of crisis. In that story, Atticus rose to the occasion. At the moment when it really mattered, he was his best self. Of course, Mockingbird doesn't tell us that. We know it because in Watchmen we see this other side of Atticus. In Mockingbird, we know of him only as the children do, because that is the internal logic of the novel. With the publication of Watchmen, however, we now know not only that the Atticus of Mockingbird was always too good to be true, but that Harper Lee knew it as well. She knew all the things that Jean Louise discovers in Watchmen, that Atticus's kindly paternalism covered ugly beliefs about racial difference, that his willingness to represent black clients was in service to the racial status quo, that Calpurnia and all of Macomb's black population lived behind a veil, that what as a child she had assumed was genuine, reciprocal love and devotion across the color line was more like an elaborate act intended to ease for whites the guilt and for blacks the burden of racial injustice. She knew all of these things and yet never told us. Why?
This is On the Porch with Silas House here on WUKY 91.3 FM. We are talking to historian and author Joseph Crespino about his brand new book, Atticus Finch, The Biography. Joe, sometimes when we're looking at people from the past whom we now see as racist or homophobic or misogynistic or violent or whatever, some people will talk about them being, quote, men of their times, unquote, as a way to understand their views on these issues. How do you feel about calling Atticus Finch a man of his times to better understand him?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's an interesting question what we actually mean when we say a man of his times. And it's usually men, right? It's not women. That's an important, maybe that's a revealing aspect of it. I think A.C. Lee was certainly a man of his times in the sense that he was subject to the blindnesses and the that looking back on people who lived in the 1930s or the 1950s that seem obvious to us when we look back on it. One of the things that I was trying to do in this book, though, is particularly, say, in regards to Harper Lee's father, is to try to understand not how Joe Crespino, looking back on A.C. Lee living in the 1930s or 1940s South, what I think of him, but how Harper Lee would have seen and understood him, her father, thinking about him, being motivated to try to write about him through this character, Atticus Finch, in her fiction in the 1950s. That's the kind, I'm trying to see the past through her eyes, rather than through our own eyes today, because I think is what gives us insight into her creative process and what she was trying to accomplish. Yes. And some of the blindnesses that A.C. Lee had were some of the blindnesses that Harper Lee shared still in the 1950s, too. Mm-hmm. And that's always kind of the tricky part of doing this kind of work. But that's how I think about doing this work as a historian, you know, to try to set aside, at least for temporarily, at least for some amount of time, my own way of seeing this character, to try to imagine the way that Harper Lee would have seen her father and the way that it impacted the kind of character she shaped in her fiction.
Yes. Sometimes when I hear people talking about Atticus Finch, the character, it becomes clear to me that they've either only ever seen the film version of him.
Right, right.
Or perhaps the film version has taken over. Because Atticus is not always seen as the perfect father by his children in To Kill a Mockingbird. Now, this is something that you get into in the book, and I love that whole section. So can you talk just a little bit about that and how they are sort of different iterations?
Yeah, one of the things I discovered in writing this book was that Harper Lee was the author of Atticus Finch. She created him, but other people played a big role in shaping him as an icon, as a myth. You know, certainly Horton Foote played a big role. He was the screenwriter who adapted the novel into the movie. And he created new scenes, and he colored the character in interesting ways. So too, of course, did Gregory Peck, who embodied the character when he played him in the movie. And one of the most fascinating documents I came across was out in Los Angeles in the Academy Motion Picture Archives, where they have the script that Gregory Peck used, his copy of the script, where he made all these notes on the script about how he was to play, how he wanted to approach different scenes. And one of the scenes that was particularly interesting was the scene where Judge Taylor comes to Atticus to ask him to take the case of Tom Robinson. Now, this is a scene that Horton Foote wrote for the movie because it doesn't exist in the book, mm-hmm. right? We learn in retrospect, the children learn after the fact that Atticus has agreed to do this. But Horton Foote wanted to dramatize it because this is a critical moment where Atticus is presented with a moral challenge. Does he do this? And in the screenplay, the way it's written, it's fairly flat. There's not a lot of kind of stage instructions as to how Peck is to interpret that. But Peck has his own interpretation. He says something like, you know, be alive. Atticus is alive with the problem. Atticus is aroused. As though Atticus has been kind of waiting for this opportunity to do something that he has believed all along, which is not at all clear, you know, that necessarily in the book that would have right. necessarily have been his reaction to that. But that's Gregory Peck kind of bringing his own shading to the character in an important way.
Yeah, I feel like the book is a lot more about Scout and Jim and Deal, yeah. and the movie's a lot more about Atticus.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. And they try, it's fascinating too, that's all in the documents, that's all in the archive.
Yeah.
And the filmmakers were trying, Robert Mulligan, early on in the process, he's very intent. The novel had won the Pulitzer, and, you know, he wants to preserve it. And Mulligan was a director who was known for being able to work with kids. They cast these two kids from Alabama, you know, who had no real formal experience in acting. They wanted authentic children, you know, child performances. And they wanted the film to be about the children. But inevitably, it became about Atticus as they had to kind of streamline the story. And as they had to give Peck his screen time, right? I mean, Peck yes. was the draw. Peck was the one who's going to bring people into the theaters and sell the tickets. And so it's a fascinating kind of story about kind of the politics of adaptation somewhere, the economics and the artistic compromises or decisions that go into adapting novels onto the screen.
Right. I know a lot of people who refused to buy or to read Ghost Set a Watchman because they felt that Harper Lee had been duped into publishing it and that buying a copy would only lead to putting money in her lawyer's pockets. Now, I don't agree with that notion, but how do you feel about that statement?
Well, you know, I read all of that, and I don't have any great insight into that process. I think that will remain a controversy for the foreseeable future until, you know, Harper Lee's biographer comes along and it settles it. But, you know, I talk to people who are very close to Harper Lee, people in Harper Lee's family, and generally, the story that comes out is that she knew what was going on and that she consented to it and mm-hmm. and that's what she wanted. But I know there still is a lot of controversy surrounding it. And in my own research, actually, I kind of set that question aside because I kind of feel like that's not something kind of that I can answer right now. Mm-hmm. Given the kind of sources that I had access to. And I wasn't really interested in it. To be honest, I wasn't interested in it because I'm glad Watchmen was published. I think right. it just gives us so much more insight into what she was trying to do and what she was up to and into the time period. So I'm just thrilled that it got out there, no matter how it got out there. And I think her fiction's a lot richer for it, for, you know, us trying to puzzle through what all that she was struggling to deal with and to try to come to grips with.
I agree. You know, that's what I would say to a lot of people is I was able to read it because it gave me new insights about Harper Lee, about To Kill a Mockingbird, etc.
Yeah.
Well, Harper Lee died in 2016, I believe. If you could have asked Harper Lee one question for this book, what would it have been? I know it's hard to narrow it down to one, probably.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great question. I think I would ask her, why didn't she come back to Watchmen? She had the seeds of a novel mm-hmm. there that she could have worked with. And I have evidence that suggests this, that she was trying to rework, that she was struggling to rework kind of some of the themes that she had been grappling with in Watchmen. You see it, it's suggested by interviews that she gives in 1963 and 1964, where she will, in interviews, she gives passages that are almost straight out of Watchmen, you know, straight out of the kind of the words that she puts in the mouth of the character Uncle Jack, or she uses certain lines that come directly out of Watchmen. I think she was struggling to try to figure out how to say some of what she had been trying to say, but mm-hmm. it was hard to say it. One, because it doesn't fit with kind of the vision of the character that she had laid out, and that character that so many people had become attached to in such a strong way at that time. So I would have liked to have known more about what she thought of that material, and why not come back to it and try to revise it and put it in a way that she could try to articulate some of the things she was struggling to articulate.
I found that so much of your book is about decency. It's often I was writing in the margins decency, because you're exploring what a decent man A.C. Lee was, and you're looking at the decency of Atticus Finch and other people throughout the book. Do you think our country is less decent today than it used to be, or decent in different ways, or what?
I think that I think there are a lot of similarities, actually, between our present political moment and the political moment in which Harper Lee was struggling to write her two books, was struggling to write both Ghost Set of Watchmen and To Kill a Mockingbird. If you look at the way that Southern politics turns in the 1950s, after the Brown decision, and after the kind of first attempts at desegregation, that authoring Lucy's entry into University of Alabama, the Little Rock crisis, that is given those. There is arising in Southern politics this militant segregationist movement, this kind of right-wing political reaction that would have been very surprising to a lot of people in the South, based on what was happening 10 years earlier, based on what was happening in the immediate years after World War II, when there were progressive movements afoot in the South, where there were liberal politicians who were being elected, who were talking about getting rid of the poll tax and economic development and opening up, you know, jobs for returning veterans and that kind of thing. And there's a hard right turn in Southern politics in the 50s after the Brown decision, and as the civil rights movement starts ramping up. And I think what you see in this book is Harper Lee trying to struggle to make sense of her own father's kind of principled conservatism in the midst of this militant segregationist movement that has arisen. Mm-hmm. And so I think she's struggling herself to kind of figure out, what good is it to be decent? How do you be decent in a time in which these folks on the far right wing are kind of moving into power in ways no one ever would have expected them to, you know, in a time when, you know, folks like Lester Maddox in Georgia, Ross Barnett, and when George Wallace, who had been a relatively moderate figure in Alabama politics, is moving hard to the right and having a Klansman as his speech writer, you know, in the speech, famous inauguration speech he gives in 1963. Nobody would have anticipated that in the late 1940s. And I think in a similar way that today, nobody could have anticipated the way in which right-wing, you know, some of the racist, polarizing sentiment that we see in our politics today is openly expressed. I think that it's just striking. And I think that, and I think that's what makes this story about Harper Lee's struggle in her own moment very relevant to trying to make sense of our own political moment.
Exactly. I was just about to say, you know, I went into this book because, like I said, of my interest in To Kill a Mockingbird and Harper Lee. But as I read more of the book, I realized that what was really speaking to me was exactly what you're saying, how relevant it is in looking at our own current crises, you know. So I do think it is a book that really transcends Harper Lee and To Kill a Mockingbird and becomes the subject matter is so large and so relevant. Our listeners are great readers, I found, by talking to them. And so I always ask my guests if they can recommend a book, other than Atticus Finch, the biography, of course, that you would tell them to read right now.
Oh, that's a good question. I think that, you know, I teach a lot of history books. I'm a professor of history. And one of the books that we just read is a book that I love. It's by the American historian Richard White, who teaches at Stanford University and is one of the most brilliant living historians of the United States. And he's written so many good books. But the book we just read, which is brilliant, it's a book called Railroaded, which is about the history of the transcontinental railroads and the building of them in the late 19th century, and just what an incredible boondoggle it was, and how it's a great kind of classic historical study about kind of the barons of capital that we oftentimes celebrate were really these deeply flawed, ignorant, misguided folks who just stumbled into their wealth and had no real great vision for how to properly develop the country economically, environmentally, socially, or whatever. So it's a great kind of expose about that late 19th century part of our past.
And what about music? What have you been listening to lately that you love?
Well, you know, I always love my wife's music, Caroline Herring. She's always so good. But I tell you one album, and I'm sure being the music aficionado that you are, you've probably known about this for years. But I had never heard the fantastic Tony Rice and Ricky Skaggs collaboration in 1980. And that is a classic work of music, and just incredible playing, incredible harmony singing, and just beautiful old bluegrass ballads and tunes. And it has enriched my listening, certainly, for this last month or so.
Great choices. Well, thanks so much for being here with us today, Joe, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much for having me, Silas. It's been a delight talking with you.
Once again, the book is called Atticus Finch, the biography, and the author is Joseph Crespino. You'll be able to find it wherever fine books are sold. I hope you'll join us for the next episode of On the Porch, and until then, be good to one another.